All right, welcome everybody to this live event with John McManus. The topic is financial terrorism, and the theme of it I pulled from this book, Hijacking America Under the Threat of Bankruptcy, and that's certainly what we're faced with today. Mr. McManus is from Brooklyn, New York. So for all the Southerners who still don't like New York, you've got a good guy from New York. So here's your proof. A lot of the attendees are from South Carolina, Georgia, and North Carolina, so I had to say that. Mr. McManus was awarded an ROTC scholarship to attend college. He chose Holy Cross College in Worcester, Massachusetts. I might have pronounced that wrong, but I'll pronounce it the way it looks. He went there for continuing his studies, and during the second half of the 4 years at Holy Cross, he chose the option of earning a commission in the U.S. Marine Corps rather than in the U.S. Navy. He graduated from Holy Cross in 1957 with a BS degree in physics and a commission as a lieutenant in the USMC. He married Mary Helen O'Reilly of Boston in the fall of 1957, and they raised four children. In 1958, his Marine detachment aboard a Navy vessel in the Mediterranean Sea was sent into Lebanon to support the Lebanese government in the midst of the nation's leftist-created civil turmoil. In 1960, he departed honorably as the active duty officer in the USMC and accepted a position as an electronics engineer with a Massachusetts firm producing transistors. This was the era when the manufacture of silicone chips began its eventual dominance in the field of electronics. Mr. McManus's constant study of history and current events led him to investigate the John Birch Society in the early 1960s. After satisfying himself that the society was the complete opposite. I'm sorry, I'm having trouble reading this. After they're satisfying himself that the society's image was a complete opposite of the image created by prominent Americans and the mass media, he joined the organization as a local member in 1964. The society hired him in 1966 as its field coordinator, which is the job I have today. So he was the field coordinator for five New England states in 1966. And he earned promotion in 1968 to the society staff at Belmont, Massachusetts headquarters. In this post, he helped to manage the society's speakers bureau and ad hoc committee programs. His steady work as a writer and speaker led JBS founder Robert Welch to appoint him the organization's national public relations director in 1973. He immediately began writing a weekly Birch Log column that soon appeared in over 100 small U.S. newspapers and also served as a popular handout among members. In 1991, he was named the society's president while continuing as its public relations director. He's the author of six books and dozens of film strips and video programs. His versatility always provided a great asset to the society's efforts. In 2016, after serving as a member of the organization's staff for 50 years, he accepted a diminished role and became president emeritus. He continues contributing to the society's work by writing, speaking, and submitting to interviews. So, welcome, Mr. McManus. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. I didn't write that
Oh, you didn't
biographical
write that. Okay.
sketch, but I don't have any problems with it.
Okay, well, I went ahead and read it, and perhaps yeah, there it provides everybody a good understanding of where you came from. Of course, because I've spent so much time with you, I think I could add a lot to it because of all that you've done during the course of all these years, and we want to get into a little bit about that. But today, a lot of Americans are paying taxes while being unemployed, while being told by their employer that they're laid off because they have suffered due to this economic crisis that's going on. And so we're undergoing sort of like a medical terrorism at this point. But I think what the heart of this is what you've been talking about for decades, and that's about what we're seeing as financial terrorism. And the globalists are going for broke, and they have an opportunity right now because we're so far in debt to get us in a tougher state of affairs. And anyways, Mr. McManus, what do you see happening right now with current events, and how does it relate to financial terrorism, as you've explained it for years?
Well, what I see happening is an increased amount of indebtedness on the part of the United States government. I don't think there's ever been a country in history that has gone into the amount of debt that we are already in and has survived. It's going to take an awful lot of effort, an awful lot of education of the public to get us out of this fix. Instead of doing what they should do, and that is cut back on spending, they seem to be very anxious to go ahead and spend more, as if spending is going to get us out of the coronavirus and so on. And it's not. I don't want to sound like I'm anti-Trump, because I'm not. I think of the alternative to Trump and I shudder, but I do know that that Donald Trump's not listening to members of the Birch Society as much as he should.
Yes, I agree. I looked at the U.S. debt clock today, and the debt today is $26.5 trillion. Now, that's just the debt. That doesn't include the unfunded liabilities, which are at, it said, $20.6 trillion. Actually, it's more than that.
I've seen figures that go as high as $32 trillion.
Yeah. Yeah. It said it in the under unfunded interest and debt, we're at 80.1 trillion. So if you add all the trillions together, we're at well over 126 trillion that if we were to get rid of all of our debt, of course we wouldn't have to pay the interest on it if we just got rid of it. But, we'd have to write a $46 trillion check to make good of what we owe today, which would cost each citizen well over, I believe, $500,000. And the average citizen does not have that. Yeah. No,
he certainly does not. On page 120 of my book that you've been showing, Financial Terrorism, I quote Lenin, the murderous dictator of the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. Lenin is said to have declared that the best way to destroy the capitalist system was to debauch the currency. And that's what's happening. The word debauch is not that well known. It means destroy the currency, destroy the value of the currency, so on. So there have been an awful lot of warnings about debt bringing down countries, bringing down civilizations and so forth. And we're doing that to ourselves. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that the government should not spend money, but it should not spend over and above what it takes in, and it should be for legitimate purposes. When Donald Trump started his campaign, he started with a very appealing slogan, "Make America Great Again." Now, I have a friend, and this is a fairly unique situation. I have a good friend that I see every week at church. And he was Trump's pilot for 10 years. For 10 years, he worked for nobody else but for Donald Trump. And he flew him wherever he wanted to go. He flew him to vacations. He flew him to this. He flew him to business meetings and so on. I asked my friend Mike, how did you like working for Trump? He said, I loved it. He said he was a great friend and a great leader. He was a great guy to have as a boss. So I said, well, how come you're not still working for him? He said, well, at one point I finally decided we needed a new plane and Trump decided we needed a new pilot. So that was the end of that. So I asked Mike, I said, do you still have friends down at the Trump Tower in New York City? He said, yes, I do. I said, well, if we wanted to get a message through to Donald, could you think we could do it? He said, what we should do is if we have a message for Donald is to send it to what the gal we call the gatekeeper down there is a lady who's a very nice lady, and nobody gets to see Trump except through her. So I said, okay, I have a simple message and I'll type it up on a sheet of paper and that's all that will appear on the paper, no letterhead, no signature, nothing else. And the message will say this: America became great not because of what government did, but because of what government was prevented from doing by the Constitution. So we sent the message off. Whether she got it, there's no doubt the fact that she got it. It was addressed to her. Her name was Rhoda something, R-H-O-D-A. Mm-hmm. And whether she was able to get it to Trump, whether he looked at it, whether he had any confidence in it, whatever, it doesn't seem to be the case. He has never uttered the phrase, but if he had done so, he would have had a tremendous positive response from responsible Americans who know that the government is spending beyond its constitutional permission, and it should stop.
Yeah. Yeah, and the U.S. Constitution is not really something that Americans, for the most part, study today. The responsible Americans do. And the Constitution is our way of playing offense against these politicians who are spending our money with in whatever way they want to. You had a video I was watching this morning, and you brought up a friend of yours, a late friend of yours, and he said when a politician starts wrestling with his conscience, he usually wins.
That's right.
I thought that was really funny.
That was Joe Sobran. Joe Sobran worked for William Buckley for 20 years and was unceremoniously dismissed when Buckley decided to start calling him a potential anti-Semite, which is absolutely false. Joe Sobran was never an anti-Semite and so on. But he was sent out the door, and it left him with no income whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Joe Sobran was a wonderful guy. I got to know him quite well, and he's passed away by now, but Joe Sobran was right. And as far as being a wit and coming up with witticisms like the one you found, it's just tremendous. Most politicians wrestle with their conscience, they win.
That's right. I've seen that happen.
I asked the people who took care of burying Joe. I went to his funeral, and I asked them if they would consider putting that on his tombstone. I think that would be a good way to remember Joe Sobran. But it wasn't done, and may yet still be done. There's room on the tombstone.
Well, if anything, we can get our members to repeat that, and so more and more people understand that humor and that understanding of what politicians deal with. They all have a conscience, but you know, if most of them usually win when they try to wrestle their conscience. Speaking of those that have often defeated their conscience, Nancy Pelosi and California Congresswoman Maxine Waters recently pushed legislation for a digital dollar. And that was done on March 23rd, immediately after this COVID-19 scare took place. And also one person that pushed for it was Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown. And he's a Democrat. And then a few weeks later, Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib from Michigan, she's a Democrat. I think she's also Muslim. And then Pramila Jayapal, a Democrat from Washington, who may also be Muslim, I don't know, but they introduced a similar proposal in April for a digital dollar. Now, why would they be proposing a digital dollar for us? And most of us shopping right now know that our stores are no longer offering, a lot of them are not offering coins back to us if we pay in cash. What's going on here, Mr. McManus? Do you know what's going on?
Well, there are all kinds of movements to destroy the currency of the United States. And unfortunately, the government of the United States is giving reasons to want to do something like that, change the system and so on. I don't want to change the system. I want to get back to what we had prior to the Roosevelt administration, and that was precious metal-backed currency. Roosevelt took us off the gold standard, and then Richard Nixon took us off the silver standard, and now we're on the paper standard. Mm-hmm. Paper is not really a very valuable substance oven by itself. So the destruction of the currency of the United States is exactly what Lenin said in the 1920s. The way to destroy the system in America is to destroy the currency. And I think this digital idea for digital currency is another plan that would simply speed up the deterioration of the money system that we still have.
And they can always turn off the internet for a few days just to really make us shudder if we all ever went to a digital currency. Okay, we have 34 attendees. Welcome, everybody. We do have one question from somebody, or somebody's raising their hand. I'm gonna allow her to talk in just a second here. If you do have questions, type them in the Q&A section, and I will do my best to ask them as long as it's relevant to this discussion. If you do want to speak and ask a question, I ask that you don't make statements. Please ask a question. And Mr. McManus will do his best to answer your question if it's relevant to what we're discussing. Bonnie, I'm going to allow you to ask your question. Go ahead. Bonnie, you should be unmuted. If you want to go ahead and ask your question, go ahead. Okay, we'll move on to Joe Inglis. Joe Inglis, chapter leader from Georgia. Go ahead. You've got to unmute yourself on your end, Joe.
Am I there now?
I can hear you now.
Okay, I think one of the reasons that this very bad about digital currency is that they'd be able to track your transactions and track where you are and what your transactions are, and of course your digital account could be wiped out. So that's very dangerous.
That's right. It's one of the truisms is the fact that an anonymity in the use of currency is a prime ingredient of freedom. And cash, you can use cash and not give up your identity, give up your phone number, your email number, or anything. If you use cash, digital currency would do away with that. I'm glad you brought that up, Mr. Inglis. Thank you for that.
I'm going to try to get Bonnie to answer her question again. Bonnie, you have to unmute yourself, okay? Bonnie, you can ask. Okay, go ahead, Bonnie. I'm going to allow you to talk here. Go ahead. You have to unmute yourself on your end. Bonnie, try again. Unmute yourself.
Am I unmuted?
You're unmuted now.
Okay, I am so sorry. I accidentally hit the hand, raised my hand, but the gentleman who asked the question, that would have been a question I was going to ask.
Very good. Well,
anyway, so sorry about that.
That's okay. We're going to make mistakes here. A lot of us are new to this technology. So, okay, if anybody has a question, feel free to raise your hand. If not, we'll keep talking here. Or you can type it in the Q&A section. Charles Schuster. I've heard that name before. Okay, Charles, you have to unmute yourself on your end.
Okay, John, how can we possibly ever get a balanced budget considering that we're so billions, trillions of dollars in debt? You know, how is that practical? I know basically 20% of our federal budget is on borrowed money, and no one really seems excited about it. But my gosh, how in the heck can we ever? I thought one way of doing it would be to you buy government security and you pay off 30 years, every year you pay 1/30th of it off. So eventually we pay off our debt. But is that practical at all?
The Constitution of the United States in Article 3, 1, says that the House of Representatives has the power to decide spending matters. In other words, spending matters cannot be introduced anywhere else except through the House of Representatives. So the House of Representatives has the power over the purse. And if we can get enough congressmen to cease spending in deficit and then spending with some left over to begin to pay off the debt, then indeed we can save our country and save us from going into in total insolvency. That's the only solution that I know of, and I have been talking about it and getting people interested in it for years. And happily, there are more and more people that begin to realize that the Congress has the power, especially the House of Representatives, to cease unconstitutional spending. For instance, what should they cease? Stop funding education. Stop funding all kinds of government agencies and government programs that are not called for or allowed or authorized by the Constitution of the United States. Get us out of wars that seem to be unendable. We've now been in Afghanistan for 19 years. And I wonder how many people, even on this webinar, as Evan calls it, realize that the United States is not really the boss in our effort in Afghanistan, but NATO is. And NATO's part of the United Nations. So the United Nations is calling the shots for the United States regarding the way the conduct of the war and the length of the war in Afghanistan is going. And I, excuse me, I think a lot of Americans would be interested to know that. And that's why we have an educational organization called the John Birch Society to get that information out. You can go to the Charter of the United Nations. I have a couple of pages of it right here. And we read in Article 52 about regional arrangements. Regional arrangements are the organizations like NATO and before it, CETO. CETO was the overseer of the war in Vietnam, which we lost. We lost that war. First time in history of the United States we lost a war. But so Articles 52, 3, and 4 in the Charter of the United Nations explain what a regional arrangement is and how you can get one started. So we started NATO in 1949 under a Council on Foreign Relations member leadership, a man named Dean Acheson. So just read through the part of the Charter of the United Nations and you find out that the Security Council shall utilize such regional arrangements for enforcement action under its authority. Go further into it. The Security Council shall be kept at all times kept fully informed of activities undertaken or in contemplation under the United Nations. So the whole thing is a setup and it's not well known. I was on a webinar like this with some people in New Jersey, some members of the society in New Jersey recently. And a fellow asked, he said, how do I get somebody interested in the John Birch Society? I said, well, if you've got somebody that's willing to listen, ask him a question. Ask him if he's aware of the fact that our troops in Afghanistan are not being controlled by American leaders, but by NATO. And that should get them interested enough to say, well, you know, can you prove that? Yeah, yes, I can prove that. What does that lead to? What that leads to is the fact that we're not calling the shots in Afghanistan. And we're not going to be able to leave Afghanistan until the United Nations regional arrangement called NATO says it's time to leave. It's incredible. I suggested, he said, I'm going to try that with some people I know. And I said, well, good. I think you might have a bit of success. And if you do, let us know. And we'll see if we can get other members to do the same thing.
All right, Skip, you are the next one here. I'm going to allow you to talk. Please unmute yourself, Skip, and then you can ask your question. Go ahead, Skip. It looks like you're unmuted right now. Are you still there? Skip, are you there? Okay, I'm going to mute him again. And Skip, if you want to ask a question, just raise your hand again and I will get your question asked. Oh, let's try this. Okay, here we go. Maybe. Okay, Skip, unmute yourself. We should be able to hear you now. Skip, please speak up. Okay, technical issues. That's fine. We'll do that. We'll try that again. Okay, Vicky, you're next. Go ahead, Vicky. Vicky, please unmute yourself. Well, apparently this technology is really good, but as far as getting people to ask questions, it's not as good. Okay, so we'll move on to Andy Wynn, and we'll see if his works here. Andy, go ahead and ask your question. You need to unmute yourself. Andy, please unmute yourself on your end.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now.
My question to Mr. McManus is that with all the stimulus money being released to the public, can we expect hyperinflation immediately?
Well, no. What has been done, of course, is put several trillion dollars into the system. And the effect on that doesn't happen immediately. But I do know from my own wife that from the time that started, which was just several weeks ago till now, the prices of groceries has gone up. She has to spend more of the dollars because they're not as valuable as they used to be. And that's what inflation is. Inflation is an increase in the amount of currency, and it takes on its value by stealing some of the value of existing currency. So what you're looking for is an increase in prices on different items, and you'll see it. You'll see it. I think probably the best place to see it would be the grocery store, but you'll see it at the gas station. You'll see it elsewhere. The dollars will not be worth as much as they used to be, and that's part of the problem.
Thank you for your question, Andy. Okay, I am going to go over here to our questions that have, I see, okay. What will change if our country is bankrupted? What will our situation look like? And I've been told by people that President Trump is the best person to bankrupt our country. And they say that they think it's a savvy thing to be doing right now, is to bankrupt the country. Mr. McManus, go ahead.
You don't want to bankrupt the country because you got to have some kind of currency. What would happen? Bankrupt the country, admit the bankruptcy, and then we'd have the International Monetary Fund of the United Nations come in and set up a whole new system. And then we'd be beholden even more deeply to the United Nations. We don't want that. We want to get back to America being an independent country, not dependent on the United Nations or any other of its subsidiaries.
Dan asks, how do we protect our financial future? Do we need to own precious metals?
Well, only precious metals certainly would make sense, because the precious metals don't lose their value. But the problem there is that if the currency finally does collapse and is it becomes worthless, which is what happened in Germany in 1923, then you start spending precious metals to get your groceries and so forth, your neighbors will be all over you. You'll find that people who have been deprived of their resources, they don't have precious metals, they can't buy groceries and so forth, and they see that you can, they're going to be after you. And it's going to amount to a chaotic situation that we certainly don't want to see happen.
Mr. McManus, you bring up a great point there. I have more people that probably I know that are prepping for the destruction of our economy than I know that are actually taking action. And I would say that there's far more people that are prepping for the bankruptcy or whatever, you know, destruction of our economy, than are taking action to call their congressman or to help people run for Congress so that we can actually get people elected that are obeying the U.S. Constitution. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that they don't have confidence in themselves to actually be able to talk to people about the U.S. Constitution or how to explain these matters publicly, which has a lot to do with the way we've been trained as Americans to not understand Americanism. What do you think are the best ways to understand Americanism if you are one that wants to help get the U.S. House representatives to start obeying the U.S. Constitution again?
Well, using the U.S. Constitution, that article, excuse me, in the Constitution that gives the power of the purse to the House of Representatives, it's there and it should be used. So the House of Representatives should not be going along with all of these deficit spending programs. They should be saying, no, we are not going to introduce a measure to spend more than we take in. Simple as that. Unfortunately, a lot of people recognize that the situation is getting pretty serious, because it's been serious for quite a while. And they don't realize what it would lead to. It would lead to people warring with each other, especially anybody who shows up with some precious metal coins to be able to purchase something. His neighbors will be all over him. It's a way to destroy a country. And that's what Lenin said. The best way to destroy a country is to debauch the currency. So I don't want to see anybody thinking that way or doing anything along those lines. What we need to do is to get back to sound spending and the Constitution itself. One way to get started on the constitutional subject is to just simply ask some questions of somebody. Ask them to find the word education in the Constitution of the United States. It's not there. Does the federal government have a responsibility to have a Department of Education? No, not even close. In fact, you can go to the communist leader back in the 30s and 40s. Can't think of his name right now, but he actually said that he wanted to have the communists take control of the education system in our country. And he could do it. You know, he's done it. He has succeeded. And it's terrible to contemplate that. So the federal government should not be in the subject of education. The federal government should not be in medicine. The federal government should not be in all kinds of areas where it has no authorization to do so under the Constitution of the United States. Constitution is still supposedly sworn to by every member of Congress every second year. We got to hold them to it and make sure that they don't exceed the powers that are given.
By the way, we have 44 people that are now attending this. So thank you everybody for joining and being part of this. This is being recorded and I will publish this later for everybody to see that it is not able to attend this, or for if you want to review the video afterwards, I will have it published so that you can review it. There was a good question asked here by Karen. Is there any chance the president would turn over the printing of money to the Treasury instead of the Federal Reserve?
Well, it would take some effort to do that. The printing is, in fact, conducted by the Federal Reserve System. That's right. It's under the U.S. Treasury Department. Treasury Department is a legitimate function of the government of the United States. It's constitutional. But it has given up a lot of its authority and its powers to the Federal Reserve. And the fact of printing the money is not as important as authorizing that the government should be involved in things that cost money. Mm-hmm. So whether it's printed by the Fed or by the Treasury Department directly, that's not as important as what spending is being incurred by the federal government, much of it totally unconstitutional.
Dan has a tough question here. He says, what do you know about the NESARA, GESARA acts relative to national and global debt forgiveness? I guess the acronyms would be NESARA and GESARA acts relative to national and global debt forgiveness. I've never heard of this.
Nor have I.
Neither of you. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I think we have a question by John. Let's see here. John Perna, I'm unmuting you right now, so you should be able to talk. John, go ahead.
If you give John Perna the microphone, you might not get it back.
Well, I can always mute him again. John, you're unmuted. You raised your hand. Feel free to ask your question. Some people have said that they don't see an unmute button on their side of the screen. And so what I'm doing now is I'm waiting a little bit longer after I press unmute for them to talk. But John, speak up if you're by your microphone. Okay, I think some people may be accidentally pressing the button to raise their hand. Okay, we'll move on to the next person here. Carmen, you are the next person here. So, Carmen, you have been unmuted. Feel free to ask your question.
Can you hear me?
Can hear you, Carmen.
So I just have a quick question about I wrote this on the questions thing. So if we do go to cryptocurrency or basically digital money, right? Is that something that's happening? Mm-hmm. Is that going to be a problem? Like, is it not a good thing that we're doing that?
Well, you lose your anonymity. You become somebody who's able to watch over all of your transactions. And you don't want that.
So is there a way to stop that?
Well, just don't go to digital money.
But I feel like, aren't we going to be forced to do that?
Well,
if we want to use money.
I guess if we're forced to do it and you need to do it in order to get groceries to feed your family, you'll do it. And I would too. But I don't want to have to do that. I would like to be able to continue to use cash.
So how can we stop that?
Well, one of the ways is to begin to start to roll back the indebtedness of the United States. We're not doing that. We're plunging into more indebtedness all the time. Just think of the saving that would be accomplished by bringing our troops home from Afghanistan. The saving that would be accomplished by getting out of the United Nations and all of its agencies. That's the kind of thing that the American people should be demanding. As you probably know, the John Birch Society's had a long-standing campaign, get us out of the United Nations. We never should have gotten involved in the first place. It was sold to the American people as something that would stop war. And there have been more wars since the United Nations was founded and we got involved in it. There have been more wars that the United States has been involved in than at any other time, in history. And the interesting thing about it is we haven't won any of the wars that we've been in ever since we joined the United Nations in 1945. And that means Korea, it means Vietnam, it means Afghanistan, it means Iraq. We haven't won a war that we've been involved in since we joined the United Nations.
But what is the probability that we'll get out? I mean...
Well, the probability is there if there are enough American people who want it. There's a bill in Congress. We've asked people to get their own congressmen to support the bill. I can remember at one point in time, there were hundreds of U.S. congressmen who supported a measure to get us out of the United Nations. And then it kind of went into a bottom drawer somewhere. And we got to bring it back. We got to get the United States out of the United Nations. But let me tell you a little story about that. Ron Paul was a congressman from Texas, and he was the one who introduced the most recent of the Get Us Out of the United Nations measures in the House of Representatives. Now, how did that come about? Well, Ron Paul had a young lady working for him who was a member of the John Birch Society, and I had helped introduce her to Ron Paul, and I knew her well. And she, on her own, contacted the Library of Congress and asked for them to send to Ron Paul's office every measure that had ever been introduced by anybody to get us out of the United Nations. So she got a stack of stuff that came to the office and she started reading through it. And she put together a Get Us Out of the United Nations piece of legislation. It only took 3 pages to get everything involved in the whole thing. And she screwed up her courage and went into Ron Paul and she said, Mr. Congressman, I'd like you to consider introducing this as a measure for Congress to consider. So he said, okay, I'll take a look at it. Well, it was a day or two later, he came back to her and he said, I like it very much. I'm going to introduce it. I changed one word. You said immediately get out of the United Nations. I think we ought to give them 2 years or a year to be able to take care of whatever needs to be done. So that young lady was a member of the John Birch Society, and she wrote the measure that congressmen have been using ever since to get us out of the United Nations. Can the John Birch Society has ever accomplished anything? Yeah. Now we got to accomplish getting out of the United Nations, which is what that measure calls for.
So when can we vote on that?
Well, have you contacted your own congressman and asked him to back the legislation that's mentioned in the bulletin, mentioned, I think, every month? The measure, I've forgotten the number.
I haven't confirmed that Carmen's a member. Carmen, are you a member of the John Birch Society? Okay.
Yes.
Okay, well, there's in the bulletin, there's a section devoted to the United Nations. I write it, in fact. And at the end of each of the articles, I say, okay, if you haven't done so, contact your congressman and get him to support the measure that calls for getting us out of the United Nations. It's the same measure that Ron Paul had introduced, written for him by his young lady member of his staff.
Yeah, Carmen, those are great questions. And my Congressman William Timmons, he's a Lindsey Graham protege. And I've worked really hard on this United Nations issue, as I did with Congressman Trey Gowdy when he used to be my congressman. And neither one of them will move in the direction of ending the United Nations. And of course, Trey Gowdy has no power anymore now that he's no longer a congressman. But I find the whole thing really funny. You know, Congressman William Timmons, he's the same age as me. And I've sent him the facts on what's going on. I've made him feel very unpleasant during meetings because of the way I've asked the questions. And he's felt really embarrassed by the fact that he doesn't know enough about the United Nations. And he responded back to me with a letter that just made false, well, not false, but he knowingly knows that the United Nations is not legal, but he's still, he replied back to me, making it sound like it was legal for us to be part of it. And as a person that believes in God, I have a big problem that the Lucifer Publishing Company runs the meditation prayer room, whatever it's called, at the United Nations headquarters. And he said that's not a problem for him. And my congressman, he says that he's a member of a church in Greenville, South Carolina. And so those are, you know, the problem that I have in my area is I have a lot of members of the John Birch Society in my area, but I am the only one that goes to meetings where my congressman is, and I make him understand, I help him to understand what's taking place. And the problem we have is we have a lot of people that know, but we have too many people that don't take action. And that has to change if we're going to save our country.
I agree. Thank you for inviting us to do that.
Thank you, Carmen. And John Perna, your hand is raised again. Hopefully we get you on here because I think you're approaching your 50th anniversary as a member in just a few days, if I remember right. So I'm going to unmute you here, John. John, you're unmuted, so you should be able to talk. John, you're completely unmuted. If there's an unmute button on your screen, press the unmute button and you can ask your question. John, we still can't hear you, and you just muted yourself. Now you're unmuted. Okay, we're still having problems there. We've got to move on. Okay, Skip, it looks like you've raised your hand again. I know you tried to ask a question earlier, and now you say you can see your unmute button. So, Skip, go ahead and ask your question. You're unmuted. Skip, go ahead. Go ahead. We can hear somebody here. Skip, go ahead and ask your question. Okay, still having issues there. It's always best if you log in through Zoom if you're going to take part in these webinars. I think that's the easiest way. Bill Behan, you've got a question. Go ahead, Bill. Bill, you're unmuted. Go ahead.
Yes, they were talking before, but what happens if we get this digital currency? Most people are not aware that in your 401k, you can move some of your money into physical gold, which you can then store at your home. So that's an option that if they go to the digital currency, there will be an active underground economy that you can participate in, especially in a rural area like where I live. Also, I want to say we have a member of our chapter, Matt Gertler, who's running for Congress in the 9th District of Georgia, and any help he can get would be appreciated. The runoff's August 11th.
Thank you for that, Bill. Bill, John, have you, Mr. McManus, have you put much thought into the 401ks that Bill's referring to?
Well, you know, it's the same problem. You can convert your 401k to a precious metal. Okay, but if we get to a point where only precious metal can buy anything, then you're going to find yourself having to beat away your neighbors who didn't do that. And we certainly don't want to get to that point.
Correct.
We're on a path to get to it, and we got to stop that path.
Yeah, Jason just commented. He said gold IRA and 401k are okay, but nothing beats physical ownership.
Well, nothing beats honest money.
Okay, we'll keep going here. Karen asks, when and how can nullification be used against those politicians that have not honored their oaths of office?
Well, nullification wouldn't be used against a particular congressman. Nullification would be used against a law, a statute. And that's something that certainly should be considered in numerous cases, but it has to be done by members of the legislature, not by the individuals. You can nullify a elected official by voting him out of office. And that's going to be accomplished when there's enough people in a community who understand that he's not obeying his oath. He's a danger to the future of the country and so forth. And that would be accomplished through education of the public, bringing them up to speed. You know, a lot of people think that they went to a good school, but they didn't learn anything about the Constitution in most cases. Constitution is a marvelous document, and it ought to be understood and it ought to be adhered to, and it's certainly not being adhered to today.
Charles has another question to ask. I'm going to get him back on here. Let's see here.
Well, John, is Medicare and Social Security legal in the Constitution or is it illegal?
Illegal.
So how would we, if we got rid of it, how would we segue it to all those that are depending on it?
Well, get to Social Security, the people who have paid into the Social Security ought to be paid in kind to get out of it. Don't take any more people into it, and eventually it will disappear. That's the only way to treat that. They never should have started Social Security in the first place. It was Franklin Roosevelt who started it. He even wanted to pack the Supreme Court in order to get it passed. So it never should have been started. People should not rely on government for their old age income. You should rely on yourself. More responsible people. And if we had more responsible people, those responsible people would be making sure that all members of the government were obeying the Constitution that they've sworn an oath to.
Well, John Perna has finally got his question in here. And so his question was, why can't we pay the national debt by giving the Fed the same thing that they gave us, a paper certificate?
Well, haven't considered that one. I don't know who's going to print the paper certificate, you know.
Would that be a form of bankruptcy if we did that? Or would that be a... I guess that'd be a nifty way of getting it done.
Actually, there's no way that we can pay the Federal Reserve. Our transactions are between ourselves and the U.S. Treasury, which is a constitutional authorized agency of government. The Fed is not a constitutionally authorized agent of the government of the United States.
So there's no way we could send them a check. Well, John Perna is probably stumped right now. I wish he could talk. I've tried to unmute him, but here we go. We'll move on to the next person here. John, you can ask another question via chat. I can see your chat questions here. There is a person by the name of Daniel here who has a question. Daniel, go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Can hear you.
Two questions, actually, on things that have already come up. First of all, how much of the recent price increase might be due to supply and demand rather than inflation? The lockdown has strikingly decreased the output of our economy. Many things are not there. And there's a tendency for supply and demand to act very quickly and sometimes inflation a little bit more slowly. That's the first question.
Well, let me answer it. The answer to your question is probably the best measure of the value of the dollar is the different prices as you get in your supermarket. There has not been a shutdown of the supply in the supermarket, so any change in price is not due to supply and demand. The change of the costs of going to the supermarket is simply a lower value of the dollar. You know, when I was a boy, when I was 10 years old, my mother used to send me to the supermarket with a wagon and a $10 bill. And I would fill the wagon with the list of things that she asked me to get and bring it back home with change from the $10 bill. Now, you take a $10 bill to the supermarket today, and you'll probably get a bag or two of groceries, and maybe not even that. So the value of the dollar has shrunk, and it has shrunk because of the printing press, and it's got to stop. And got to get back to precious metal-backed currency. And if we had that, then the prices wouldn't change so drastically. Okay, you had another question.
Second, on Social Security, if we are going to pay off those who are in the system, where's all that money going to come from? Granted, if we don't, it's unfair, but then the whole system is unfair, and Ponzi schemes are always unfair. Well, where's all that money going to come from to pay them off?
Well, if we got out of the if we abolished the Department of Education, Department of Housing, the Department of this, the Department of that, and so forth, there would be a lot of money left over to pay off people who have been become dependent on the Social Security system. I know of no other way to explain that except what I just said.
Well, all of those should go, but they don't come close to the Social Security debt. The Social Security debt is unpayable, and I think it's irresponsible for us to make promises like that.
Well, the promises, you're referring to the promises that were made beginning in the 1930s? I know of no other way to get out of the problem we're in, and that is to stop spending and to pay off, of course, to pay off legitimate debts that we might have.
Yeah, I think Mr. McManus, you're thinking of the proper way to do this. This isn't going to be an easy process of doing this if we are able to do it, and we've got to do it in a we've got to keep our integrity in the process. And those that have, I know many people who have never heard that Social Security is unconstitutional, and they've paid their whole lives into it, expecting it to be the income that keeps them going when they're retired. And so there needs to be, from somewhere, if we can possibly do it, an in-kind amount that's given as a way of honoring what these people thought they were getting. But the way we're going right now, if we switch into digital currency, there's likely going to be nothing for these people.
That's right.
And so at least we would try to do it honorably, whereas the other way is not honorable at all.
Well, you know, if the solution that I suggested here is ever put out and adopted, there would be a lot of people who would say, look, I don't need to be repaid for what I put into Social Security. Scratch my name off the list completely. I'm glad you're doing something responsibly here. Take care of the people who need it until they're no longer around, and then we'll have our country back again. That's a solution that's possible, and something that I think ought to be considered.
I hardly know any people other than myself and my wife who take that position. That it's almost a non-existent position.
So
nobody's volunteering to go without it.
So your answer to the problem is simply you don't have any answer. You're just going to say, okay, stand by and let the steamroller come and come right over us.
The answer is work till we die. That's the biblical scriptural answer. Retirement's not a natural thing and never has been since the beginning of the world until Bismarck started that.
Well, that's
the German dictator.
That's another subject for another day.
Mr. McManus, you're still working. Mr. McManus was just on tour with me and Charlotte, and we went to Myrtle Beach together just a few months ago. So anyways, it's those are interesting thoughts there, Daniel. And I'm going to let Jack Haynes ask the next question.
Yes, Evan, I'm curious, Mr. McManus, what do you think was going to happen if the government decided to default on what they owe?
Well, you mean announce that they're not going to pay off indebtedness?
Well, it'd be like a Chapter 11, you know, bankruptcy. The government says, hey, we can't pay the bills. They go into bankruptcy. This is what Russia did, or the USSR did.
Well, I think if it comes to that, I think that would be the end of constitutional government in the United States. I think then we would have a dictator, and I don't want to see that happen.
I'm not sure I agree with you, but that's okay. That's okay. I'm just curious what your opinion was. Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Jack has more of a different opinion. That's okay. You know, we don't know how that would play out. But I think, Mr. McManus, you've studied this for so long. You know, the longer somebody's been the John Birch Society, I think the longer we're willing to deal with the reality. I remember when I first got in the John Birch Society, I was convinced I could change my congressman, who at the time was Trey Gowdy. I could convince him to be a constitutionalist in the matter of no time. And I met with him, and I realized that was not going to happen anytime soon. And in fact, it never did. And I like the, you know, I've heard this from you multiple times, but you've made the comment in your speeches, Mr. McManus, where you said, well, what would it be like if you, you know, with your spouse that you're married to, if you followed through with 70% of the, you know, of the agreement in the marriage.
Yeah.
And so we have a lot of people that are forgiving to those who are 80% on the Freedom Index or 70% on the Freedom Index. But could you go through with how you explain that to people? Because I think that's a very good way of teaching it.
Well, you ask a congressman to abide his oath. Mm-hmm. His oath is to support and defend the Constitution of the United States of America, right? And that doesn't mean to do it 60% of the time. It means all the time, all right? Now, we put up with that and we allow a guy to have a 60% voting record or 70%. and we think that, we're fortunate. We have a congressman who's really a good guy, and he's only violating the Constitution 30% of the time. You know? Try that with your wife someday and see how long that marriage will last.
Yeah, 99% wouldn't work for me. So I have to remain at 100%.
Listen, I'd like to make a comment here. I fear we're talking to people, some people who are almost to the give up stage, that there's nothing that can be done to save our country. That they're wrong. I see others who are at the position where they're just simply trying to make it for a few more years before the steamroller comes down Air Street and steamrolls over them. You know, don't plan to lose. That's what I'm saying. Don't plan to lose. Plan to win. All right. So, I chided an audience one time with Robert Welch sitting right next to me while I was speaking. And I chided the audience because I knew some people who were buying dried food and they were building a cabin in the woods and they were getting ready to lose. And I said, stop doing it. I said, now let me tell you what I'm going to do after we defeat the conspiracy. I'm going to take a trip on one of those very slow ocean freighters. going around the world, and I'm going to read all the books that Robert Welch thinks I've read.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was hard to keep up with Robert Welch when it came to reading, right?
That's right. Absolutely.
Well,
I want to encourage everybody. The battle that we're in can be won. It's not going to be easy. It's not going to be automatic, but it's going to be, it can be accomplished, and it's going to be accomplished sooner as we get more people to understand. Understand what? Understand the Constitution. Understand how it's being violated. Understanding what good government really means. And make sure that whoever you elect to office, whoever is elected for your district and so forth, obeys his oath to the Constitution of the United States. Get us out of the United Nations. Support your local police. Do not allow them to become a federal agency. And that's something that's speeding along these days, and we got to stop it. The John Birch Society has successfully warded off several threats to total government and so forth. We're a major player in getting people to understand that global warming is not going to kill the country. It's not going to swamp the earth, right? Other things like that. The civil rights anarchy of the 60s and into the 70s was stopped by the John Birch Society. And we can stop other things if we have enough people doing the job of a member of the society, and that is wake the town and tell the people. It can be done, and all I'm saying is to those of you who are doing it, thank you, keep it up, do more if you can, and others, get back into the fight.
Okay. Well, everybody that's on here, I know there's a couple questions. We'll try to have Mr. McManus on again here in the near future. If you would like his latest book, the John Birch Society, its history recounted by someone who was there, you can send him a check for $20. I put this in the chat box. Send it to John McManus, P.O. Box 3076 in Wakefield, Massachusetts, zip code 01880. Again, that's John F. McManus, P.O. Box 3076, Wakefield, Massachusetts, 01880. Send your check for $20 there, and he will send you back an autographed copy of this very thick book, almost 400 pages. Well, Mr. McManus, thank you.
Have you read the whole thing?
I read the whole thing, yeah, and I use it all the time, yeah.
Good.
I love it. Yeah. So I am keeping up with current John Birch Society books, but I've got this book right here. I've still got to read that, but that was written before my time in the John Birch Society, so I'm playing some catch up.
There's a lot of explanation about the Federal Reserve in that book, and one of the chapters heads off with Karl Marx would have loved the Fed.
Yes, he would. No doubt.
Okay. Well, good. It's been good to be with you and your listeners, and I'll be happy to do it again sometime. Just catching on. I've got dates now with the coordinators in Idaho and in where I don't know.
That's
where.
Great. That's great. Well, we field coordinators need to use you, and then also our chapter leaders. So, and just so all the chapter leaders that are on this call, you can contact Mr. McManus and do the same thing with him with local people in your area. And this is how we're going to win the education battle. We have to be the ones educating as many Americans as possible.
Okay.
Well, all right.
Thanks very much, Evan, and we'll talk to you soon again.
Okay, everybody. This video will be uploaded on the Bircher Podcast, which is available on iTunes. So if you go to Bircher Podcast, B-I-R-C-H-E-R, or if you go to my YouTube channel, Evan Mulch, E-V-A-N-M-U-L-C-H, you will find this YouTube video available to you. Thanks, everybody, so much, and God bless you.